from Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 30, 2003. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandes. As the CIA is given 48 hours to hand over pre-war intelligence information, a new report exposes the companies that gained Iraq reconstruction contracts as large Republican Party campaign contributors. With election campaigning for Democratic presidential hopefuls escalating, we look at the new House Party phenomenon. And in part four of our special series, we look at how France and the EU are using immigration laws to target poor African countries. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The judicial nomination of Charles Pickering lost another political battle today. Republicans tried to garner enough votes to defeat a Democratic filibuster against George W. Bush's recommendation to the Federal Appeals Court. Representative Charles Schumer of New York explains his opposition to Pickering.
The Fifth Circuit has a grand tradition of being the leader on civil rights. It has more minorities than any other circuit. And to nominate somebody to that hallowed court that is opposed by so many of the people in the area who know him because he is not a strong advocate for civil rights is a huge mistake.
Today, the U.S. military attempted to justify delays in destroying the nation's huge stockpile of chemical weapons. Kevin Little reports from the Capitol.
Defense Department officials admitted to Congress that they will miss the next deadline to destroy the world's second-largest stockpile of chemical weapons. Under the Chemical Weapons Treaty, the United States was to have eliminated 40% of its 31,000 tons of arsenal by 2007. But witnesses today said safety, time, and costs will delay that goal. Craig Williams, director of Chemical Weapons Working Group, says community activists have been fighting the military to ensure that chemical weapons will be destroyed using technologies that keep residents living around the facility safe. Areas like Anniston, Alabama, use a method of incineration for destruction, which he says puts the community in serious risk.
The track record of these incinerators show that they are unreliable and they are not dependable and can't operate for a sustained period of time without major problems that shut them down.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Kevin Little.
Southern California welcomed a much-needed drizzle today after hot Santa Ana winds fueled flames. Scientists say no one should be surprised that the normal process trims suburban sprawl. Teresa Wiersbianska reports from KPFK in Los Angeles.
According to experts, fires are very common this time of year in Southern California. Mike Reed is a professor of geography at Glendale City College.
What surprises me the most is that anyone's surprised. At this time of year, this is to be expected. And while these are bigger than we've seen in much as 10 years, these are very common.
Suburban sprawl is particularly fire-prone. As more homes are built next to open spaces, natural brush fires easily spread to populated areas. Reed adds that Southern California canyons are attractive to housing developers, but canyons are also particularly susceptible to fires since they're essentially tunnels for the high winds that fan the flames of wildfires. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Teresa Wiersbianska in Los Angeles.
Today, the Delhi High Court acquitted two people accused of attacking India's parliament in December of 2001 and sentenced two others to death. Miranda Kennedy reports from New Delhi.
S.A.R. Gilani, a Kashmiri University lecturer, and Afsan Guru, the wife of one of the accused, were acquitted in today's judgment. But the court declared that Afsan's husband and another man were Jaish-e-Mohammed terrorists and sentenced them to execution by hanging. The acquittals were a victory for India's secular left, who have argued an unpopular case in favor of Gilani's innocence. At a news conference today, Gilani became emotional, describing his torture in prison.
I feel more stronger to stand against the oppression and to fight for the rights of people of Kashmir.
Nine people were killed and 16 injured when armed militants stormed India's parliament in December 2001. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New Delhi.
The United Nations Security Council agrees there are too few women serving on peacekeeping missions, but are still taking no action to change. From the United Nations, Heather Risby.
It's the third time in the past 3 years that the Security Council has held an open meeting to discuss women's role in strengthening the UN efforts for international peace and security. In October 2000, it passed a resolution recognizing that in order to prevent conflicts and help restore peace in the war-torn regions, the recruitment of women in the peacekeeping operations must be enhanced. UN officials say while some progress has been made to achieve gender balance in the peacekeeping operations, the number of women recruited by the UN remain dismally low. The Security Council, which does not have a single woman to represent as ambassador from any of the 15 member nations, agreed with the UN officials but did not take any further action. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate Intelligence Agency is demanding that CIA Director George Tenet hand over confidential documents pertaining to pre-war intelligence on Iraq by tomorrow. The Senate Intelligence Committee is also calling on Tenet to testify before it releases a much-anticipated report scrutinizing the intelligence of pre-war Iraq. Also, a congressional conference committee has approved President Bush's $87 billion request for Iraq, in which the Democratic attempt to require Iraq to pay some of the reconstruction costs back was defeated. Military spending slightly increases to $66 billion. This comes as a new report shows that some 70 companies have won up to $8 billion of government contracts for work in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as Mitch Jeserich reports, those 70 companies combined have donated about $49 million in campaign contributions, mostly to the Republican Party.
The Senate Intelligence Committee is working on a report analyzing errors in pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Though the committee members say the report is almost finished, they also say the committee is lacking specific information from the CIA. Mississippi Senator Trent Lott is a Republican member on the committee.
We're moving toward, you know, a report, and there are some gaps in material that we've received, and we are requesting specific pieces of information that have not yet been provided.
What about the Democratic charge that the Republicans on the committee are trying to put the blame on the CIA for not finding the weapons of mass destruction?
We're trying to find out what information did the CIA have, what did they base their analysis on, and then find solutions. They're interested in trying to fix blame, and all they really want is try to get it into the White House so it's all the president's fault.
The Senate Intelligence Committee has become divided. With a pending report, Democratic senators are accusing the committee's Republican leadership of shielding President Bush and his administration from scrutiny on the evidence given for invading Iraq, and instead focusing the blame of faulty intelligence on the CIA. Democratic members on the committee are threatening to launch their own investigation into the White House, which under committee rules would be able to subpoena documents and require members of the Bush administration to testify. Meanwhile, Congress is close to approving President Bush's $87 billion supplemental request for Iraq and Afghanistan. On Wednesday night, a conference committee stripped a measure that would have required Iraq to pay back half of the reconstruction money. Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings heads the Congressional Black Caucus that opposed the president's request.
Our concern with the $87 billion is that, first of all, we don't even know what happened to the $79 billion that we allocated a few months ago, particularly when we're getting letters and emails from our constituents in the field saying they don't have the appropriate armor and do not have the appropriate necessities that they need on a day-to-day basis.
Congress has made minor changes to President Bush's original $87 billion request. Though almost all the money goes to Iraq, the reconstruction money for Afghanistan is slightly higher at $1.2 billion. While Congress reduced the amount for Iraq reconstruction by $1.7 billion, it raised funds for the military by an additional $200 million. The Bush administration likes to compare the $18.6 billion for Iraqi reconstruction to the Marshall Plan that provided reconstruction money to Europe after World War II. Much of the money from the Marshall Plan eventually wound up in the hands of American companies, and the same can be said today in Iraq. A study by the Center for Public Integrity shows that 70 American companies have been awarded $8 billion so far in Iraq and Afghanistan. The center's executive director, Charles Lewis, calls those companies major political players that have contributed millions in campaign dollars to the Bush administration.
96% of the American people don't contribute a dime or a penny to any politician. A check of $1,000 comes from 0.1%. So if these companies are giving $49 million over 12 years, and many of them come from government or are returning to government and coming in and out of the door and are hanging out, this is not ordinary America here, and they're all getting rich.
Political connections of Bechtel, which has received $1 billion, and Vice President Cheney's former Halliburton, which has received a couple billion itself, are well known. But Lewis says there are other well-connected companies that are sharing in the reconstruction money, such as the $38 million so far received by Science Applications International Corporation.
They are basically setting up an entire media in Iraq, but they're not known generally in Washington or around the world, I don't think, for doing that kind of work. All of the Iraqi government authorities right now, the council that was created, are all employees of SAIC.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Next week, voters in and around Portland, Oregon, will be voting on whether to create a PUD, or People's Utility District, also known as a Public Utility District. Portland General Electric, which currently supplies energy to Portland, is still owned by Enron. Supporters of the PUD are hoping that citizens will see the importance of taking control of their own energy and taking it away from Enron. But PGE is leading a multi-million dollar advertising campaign to try and scare voters out of choosing public power. Andrew Stelzer has more from Portland.
In 2002, when Enron was discovered to have illegally created an energy crisis and blackouts rolled through California, the cities of Sacramento and Los Angeles had no problems. Their power stayed on. The reason is that these cities have public utility districts, or PUDs. Instead of an electric company, the people own the equipment and the grid which generates and distributes electricity. Public power districts also exist in Seattle and Long Island, New York.
It works fine. I haven't heard a bad story yet. And that's what I keep pressing. Where's the bad arguments?
David Covington is a journeyman lineman, and he's worked for PGE for 24 years. He's also running for election to the 5-member board that would be in charge of the Multnomah County People's Utility District. Covington says employees at PGE have been lobbied by their employer to vote against public power.
They have a lot of emails come out. For a couple weeks, we had to sit down and watch these propaganda videos, and most of it's all false. In the office, I mean, a lot of those people are real scared because they don't hear the other side of the story. All they hear is, oh, your jobs will be gone, and it's nothing but a campaign of fear, and it's working.
PGE and Pacific Power and Light are spending around $2 million on the campaign to defeat the PUD measure. Public power supporters have a significantly smaller advertising budget, $26,000. Oregon has a vote-by-mail system. People can also drop off their ballots at public libraries, like these folks at the Central Library in downtown Portland.
I find it interesting that all of the vote no on it are sponsored by Enron. And any time they sponsor it all, it tells me I should probably go the other direction.
I'm for it. Lower rates and closer to the residents who pay the rates.
And how do you think it's going to turn out?
I think it'll pass. There'll be a woman elected to this PUD.
That woman may be Netta Mae Rimel, a 77-year-old Republican who's running to be a member of the board of directors.
Unfortunately, their television ads are really good. I've talked with a friend, and she mentioned this voting business. And I said, well, I hope you're voting yes. She said, I voted no. I don't want another layer of government. Lie number one.
In 1992, Oregon citizens filed a statewide ballot measure attempting to close the Trojan nuclear power plant. PGE owned the power plant and spent a record $5 million on advertising to defeat the measure to close it. The measure failed, but within a week of the election, the plant suffered another leak and PGE themselves shut Trojan down permanently.
The 1990 and 91 situation, they just spent so much. And those of us out in the boondocks weren't really aware of how much they spent, but we knew what the advertising was. And then from then I've watched them. And when I heard that somebody was doing something about it, almost a year ago, I said, let me find those people.
PGE claims that left alone, they will either become an independent company or be sold. But if they are put up for sale, there is no guarantee that anyone would buy them at Enron's asking price. Also, PGE may be sold in parts to different companies, a formula that led to record prices for power in California. For employees like Covington, there are concerns about their pensions, which could disappear if Enron's creditors take control of PGE.
I'd like to know more about what's going on with the pension, but we can't seem to find that information because they're being awfully secretive about it. You know, they're running the company and they got the control of the company until they don't like the questions coming at them, and then it's, well, Enron controls us, and then, you know, they use the Enron card when it's convenient.
PUD supporters estimate they need 100,000 votes to convert Multnomah County to public power. For FSRN, from Portland, Oregon, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
2 weeks after he stood in the White House Rose Garden to deliver threats to people who travel from the U.S. to Cuba without permission, President Bush was last week caught off guard at the level of support from his own party for a relaxation, not strengthening, of travel restrictions to the island. In an overwhelming 59-36 vote, the Senate, 19 of them Republicans, have followed the House of Representatives in attempting to lift the effective travel ban to Cuba. The president, however, has promised to veto the bill if it reaches his desk, and yesterday lawmakers announced that Republicans will likely pull the Cuba travel provision from the bill to avoid President Bush using his veto, which they say would kill an important transportation funding bill. Our correspondent in Havana, Joseph Muti, has more.
Cubans are used to the short-lived highs that come from the U.S. Congress. A vote that will favor Cuba in some fashion may briefly raise hopes for a softening of restrictions imposed by Washington on Havana, and then ruthless slashing or watering down of the proposed legislation will follow. There's almost a collective guilty conscience in Congress whenever any legislation is voted that could be construed as favoring Cuba. Dulcio Osorio, who works as a nurse in a maternity hospital here in Havana, agrees.
It's inevitable. If the U.S. Congress votes on something that may improve relations with Cuba, it has to then look around for something bad to offset the good it has done. This is always done with Cuba, so we are not very optimistic.
The real issue, says classical guitar student Pedro Acosta, is not whether the travel restrictions are good or bad for Cuba or those who want to visit the island, but whether they are fair to U.S. agribusiness. The 19 Republican senators that broke rank are mostly from farm states.
The U.S. farmers are desperate to come and do business here. They see their European counterparts doing very well and feel that U.S. business interests are suffering.
Every year, lawmakers vote overwhelmingly to support trade with Cuba, says Steve Pringle, the legislative director of the Texas Farm Bureau. But, he adds, the congressional leadership and the Bush administration do everything they can to thwart the will of the people. So Cubans aren't jumping up and down yet at the prospect of receiving what the Cuban Ministry of Tourism estimates as 1 million U.S. visitors in the first year after the effective travel ban is lifted. That figure is making mouths water in a less powerful but very vocal sector of U.S. business, the travel industry. Few doubt that the travel restrictions and ultimately the blockade will be lifted, but the recent Senate victory is already being undermined by Republican congressional leaders determined to avoid a showdown with Bush. They're trying to drop the travel restriction amendment off the Treasury spending bill to which it is attached. Alberto Montaner works for a Canadian music agency in Havana and feels that the White House ignores the wishes of its own people.
Yes, I think this is the fourth time that the U.S. Congress has voted to lift the travel ban. Now, for the first time, the Senate has done the same thing. So what kind of democracy, you may wonder, what kind of democracy George Bush wants to impose on all of us Cubans if he's not hearing, he's not listening, he's not paying attention to what his own representatives in the United States are saying for 4 years in a row.
And what is the White House afraid of? Asks Cuban travel agent Jose Fernandez.
Yeah, I think they are afraid to have their own people come and seal for themselves. I think that the people-to-people program was too successful. Then they will see that we are like more or less like them. We laugh, we cry. We are frustrated, and yes, we don't sleep in dungeons or have loudspeakers chant political slogans at us all day.
The general feeling in Havana is indeed that although last week's Senate vote is a welcome development, it's nothing really to write home about. The travel restrictions will be lifted. Everyone knows that. But it's been four decades, so what's a few more months? In Havana, for Free Speech Radio, I'm Joseph Muti.
On the heels of a tragic drowning last week when some 60 Somalis died as they tried to illegally enter Italy, interior ministers of the five largest economies in the European Union gathered in western France to lay the groundwork for what they hope will be an EU-wide policy against terrorism and illegal immigration. For many Senegalese, escaping poverty with hopes of economic prosperity is becoming a distant reality due to recent policies by France and the EU. As we continue our 15-part special series looking at the international war on terror and how it's affecting global civil liberties, our correspondent in Senegal, Njaga Sek, brings us part 4.
Since 9/11, Senegalese immigration suffered a severe blow with restrictions for visa status increased. Many Senegalese seek economic freedom and opportunities in their former colonizer France. Recently, France's Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy enacted an immigration zero policy, modeled after the policies of Giuliani during his term as mayor of New York, now making it hard for Senegalese to obtain visas to France. Those detained in France face deportation on chartered flights. As a result, Senegalese nationals turn to Italy, a country in need of cheap labor. But European Union regulations, known as Schengen, states that countries in the EU must follow a common immigration policy, tightening border entries. Bachimbay, Senegalese national, was deported from France in chartered flights last June.
Bonjour, on m'a rapatrié comme ça, sur un charter, un avion charter.
Just one morning, I was deported on a chartered flight. Life was very difficult here before I left. Today it's worse. We do our utmost to find jobs, but there's nothing to do. And we have our families to sustain. They count on us. All that I want now is to go back there because my business is there.
Je ne peux pas le laisser tomber, quoi.
Currently, 10% of Senegal's 10 million population live abroad. Free trade policies and the race for globalization has left many Senegalese workers with immigration as the only option of finding hope. 54% is below poverty line. The economy is characterized by a slow growth of its GDP, an average of 2.4%. Still, with the deportation issue, France remains Senegal's main source of income. Visiting neighboring Mali, French President Jacques Chirac, in an interview with RTS, Senegal's national TV, says Africa should fight against illegal immigration.
Je souhaite que nos deux gouvernements continuent à travailler de bonne foi.
I hope our two governments will continue to work together to reinforce the struggle against illegal immigration, but also to stop the action of the unscrupulous mafia who exploit in a shameful way hopes they promise but they can't confirm. Incentive plans to keep Senegalese in the country have failed due to a lack of leadership and budget management. Senegal and France's immigration policies date back to 1945. They have been revised over the years according to political realities. Today, with French Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy's judicial restrictions, 70,000 Senegalese immigrants face deportation. Human rights groups voice their disapproval of these deportations. Emile Djeme, Secretary General of RADO, Pan-African Connection for Human Rights.
Vous voyez un peu quel visage le monde aura?
What could the world look like if each nation expelled the undesirable people in illegal situation? The United Nations should hold a special session about the immigration issue. We should also reinforce immigrating countries and help them develop employment policies. Since early March, some 130 nationals have been deported back to Senegal. In response, Senegal has established policies to return French nationals. In Senegal, this is Njaga Sek for Free Speech Radio News.
Public forums that fuel debate are common during election time. This year's race for the Democratic Party nomination has received a boost with a populist twist known as house parties and meetups. Powered in part by the internet, the idea is simple. Individuals who live in close proximity come together in someone's living room or favourite coffee house to discuss issues and candidates. A number of Democratic Party candidates are taking advantage of the phenomenon. The most numerous are those being held for two candidates, Howard Dean and Denis Kucinich, who together have hosted some 4,500 house parties and meetups since September. Martha Baskin takes us behind the scenes to one such house party in Seattle.
There's organic homegrown tomatoes and goat cheese at this party, organic blackberries and raspberries from the same garden, pumpkin bread, meringue pie. The crowd of 20 is packed into the living room of a 1920s bungalow that boasts a bright orange sofa and Mexican artwork. The party is for voters drawn to presidential candidate Congressman Dennis Kucinich. His name rhymes with spinach, say supporters. He's good for you. The talk is concentrated, deep. It runs the gamut from how to challenge traditional party politics and inform the uninformed to how to organize for Democratic caucuses. Globalization, NAFTA, the WTO, corporate hegemony and war, healthcare and jobs, surface and resurface.
There's a sense of disempowerment going on so much with politics, and he's such a sort of like secret weapon.
20-something Danielle Ressler is excited about the possibility of reinventing politics, as she puts it, with Kucinich. Everyone takes a turn explaining why they're here. Parties of this sort, grassroots efforts coordinated on a national scale, are largely the purview of the Democratic Party. Parties held by Republicans for George Bush are usually closed to the press fundraisers, where guests pay hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. A party at the estate of the CEO of Chiquita, Charles Lindler, raised $1.7 million for Bush early this month. Democratic parties encourage but don't require contributions, which average between $25 and $75 per person. The most numerous have been those held by supporters of Kucinich and Dean. Dean's house parties started in Vermont at his own suggestion and have raised over $1 million from more than 13,000 donors at more than 2,000 house parties since February.
People have decided on their own that they really do have the power to make a difference.
Betty Means, Dean campaign spokesperson.
We've got people who knock on doors in their precincts, go flyering, and really take democracy into their own hands.
Kucinich's campaign says its parties evolved independently. On International Peace Day alone, September 21st, Kucinich supporters held over 1,000 parties and raised $400,000. Since then, hundreds of additional parties have brought in hundreds of thousands more dollars. The web is also wiring the movement. 20% of party attendees mention moveon.org as their source of information. At a Dean party, Joe Lawson, who IDs himself as working in cable TV marketing, said he came because he had to find a place to take his passion about fixing America's problems.
I'm going to go knock on doors. I'm going to talk to other American citizens. I'm going to look people in the eye one-on-one and say, I know what you're hearing in the media. I know your fears about terrorism, but you've got to look at some other things happening here. You've got to look at the future of your children. You've got to look at the money that we have available for schools and education for social programs, for jobs.
In the absence of comprehensive campaign finance reform, such as public financing of elections and ample free time on television, house parties will become an important component to any populist candidacy. Bush expects to shatter all records by spending $175 million or more by the end of next summer. Passage of McKay-Feingold last year achieved some campaign finance reform by banning soft money contributions. But hard money contributions were increased to $2,000 per person, with corporate PAC money widely accepted as crucial to the race. Of the two candidates focused on for this story, Dean accepts such money, Kucinich does not. Back at the Kucinich party with the bright orange sofa, Jan IDs herself as a 43rd District Democrat.
I think the Democrats really need to pick someone who isn't a lackluster candidate. They need to pick somebody who people can really get behind and who has really a substantial policy. Let's not sell ourselves short, and we should go for it.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.